Welcome to the Open House Podcast. Conversations exploring life, faith and hope with Stephen O'Doherty.
When the proposed plebiscite on same-sex marriage became a survey conducted by the Australian Bureau of Statistics, it created a legal dilemma. A plebiscite, of course, would have been run by the Electoral Commission and subject to the well-established rules of fair play about disclosure, authorisation and so on contained in the Electoral Act. But the voluntary postal survey is not covered by that act, and so the Parliament has passed legislation to govern the period between the sending of the ballots and the 15th of November, when the result will be declared. The Marriage Law Survey Additional Safeguards Act 2017 is the legislation, and amongst other things, it acts to prevent misleading or deceptive advertising and hateful and harmful speech on both sides of this hotly contested issue. And in those matters, it actually goes further than the usual provisions that apply during an election campaign. On Open House, we spoke with Associate Professor Neil Foster of the University of Newcastle. He thinks there's reason to be concerned about some of the far-reaching implications and consequences of this law.
Well, I have a few concerns. I'm concerned about some of the implications of this legislation for people not being really able to know what they can say and what they can't say. And there's a couple of bureaucratic things that are going to be people are going to have to pay attention to. On the other hand, it's true to say that there are some good things in the legislation in terms of encouraging people not to be penalised for the expression of their views on either side of the debate. So as a statement of general principle, that's a useful thing.
What are the principles that underlie the law on this issue? What are the principles that we're trying to get to as a democracy?
Well, I suppose the underlying broad principles are that we want to set up a system where people aren't given false information in relation to a vote that they're expressing. And so one of the features of the legislation is to require an explicit authorisation statement so that people are at least the incentive for people to make false statements is reduced because they have to attach their name to it. So that's an authorisation type of provision. And there are provisions in here which are designed to penalise offering bribes to people or making misleading statements about the electoral process. And so I guess those sorts of principles are we want people to be able to participate in an informed way in expressing their views.
Yeah, all right. So, and then there's a transparency principle, as you've said, which not only applies to whether information is misleading, but so that we know who it is that's trying to influence our opinion.
That's right, yes.
Which means that in an election campaign, or even here in this marriage survey, say a union, for instance, that might run a campaign about penalty rates, it needs to authorise that because at the end of the day it's a third-party endorsement, I suppose, for what the Labor Party is saying, just to use that example.
Yes, so the idea is that if someone puts out something that's going to influence people's vote in a normal election, if we can put it that way, then you want to be able to track down the source of that. If you discover that it's wildly inaccurate, you want to reduce the incentives for people to make false statements, which will wrongly affect the way people vote. Now, in this particular legislation also, there's been concern then expressed about the material not just being misleading but perhaps being harmful, and that's the additional part of this legislation prohibiting certain statements that are vilifying or threatening, that I think is a matter of a sort of additional thing that you don't find in the normal electoral legislation, and there are always difficulties when you're impinging on people's free speech in these areas of striking that right balance.
In the case where the law now says you can't provide misleading information in relation to this marriage survey, of course, what's misleading and what's not misleading is like beauty. It's very much in the eye of the beholder. So if I say, look, religious freedom is going to be impinged by a yes vote, immediately someone like the Leader of the Opposition or indeed many of people on the yes side of the case, they say, well, no, it's not. No, it's got nothing to do with that. It's only about love. And then I might say, well, yes, hang on a minute. To say it's about love is misleading because this bill has nothing to do with love. It's about the definition of marriage. And so how are the learned judges who interpret all of this going to decide what's misleading and what's not?
Well, that's a very good question. And in fact, I think that the situation might not be quite as bad as I feared when I first also looked at this provision. Section 17 of the legislation prohibits misleading matter in relation to completing the survey, it says. And in fact, it's worded slightly differently to some other parts of the legislation. I actually think, and I think that I think I can justify this claim, that Section 17 is about misleading people about where to send their vote or how to fill it in or who to send it to. It's about the process of the survey rather than the content. So I actually think that they have chosen not to penalise statements as to which there's immense debate on both sides about the substance of the benefits or the detriments of same-sex marriage under Section 17. Section 17, to my mind, the way it's worded, Section 17.1c prohibits material that's likely to mislead or deceive an enrolled person in relation to the provision of a marriage law survey response. So I think it's to do with people not being able to fool others about where they should send their envelopes or whether it's compulsory or not.
All right, well, that's really, really encouraging to hear your take on that, and I think we'll choose to agree with you until someone else says otherwise. Well, Neil, the other area that's quite controversial and will be the subject, I think, of claim and counterclaim is in this area of vilification. And so it says you're not allowed to vilify, and it uses some other words, during the course of this debate. Now, what do you make of that?
Yes, so Section 15 is the relevant provision here, and it says that you're not to vilify, intimidate, or threaten to cause harm to another person if the motive for that action relates to their views on the marriage law survey question, or, you know, your belief about their views on that question. And then it even goes a little bit further and says you're not allowed to vilify, intimidate or threaten on the basis of a person's religious conviction or sexual orientation. So this is an attempt to do what I think is always very difficult, which is to legislate for polite and respectful debate. I think that there are a number of issues here. The fact is it does set the bar reasonably high. None of us would really support, I imagine, intimidation or threatening harm to people.
Well, certainly
I
would not.
Hope we certainly wouldn't, although sadly some of the behaviour of demonstrators occasionally seems to breach that provision. But the vilification thing is a tricky one because it's not clearly defined in the legislation. It's not really a term of art that's well understood. It's a term of art that's been used to describe other laws, but I was just doing some research and it's very rarely used in legislation itself, and so there's a bit of debate about what it really means.
Do we have a clear definition anywhere in Australian law, or indeed a clear sense of the courts interpreting, which is as good as, of what vilify would actually mean?
I'm afraid that so far as my research has gone, so far I haven't been able to discover a clear interpretation of vilification, a clear explanation of the word. And the word also, as often happens in legislation, will take its meaning from its context as well. And so there's a great deal of uncertainty here. My view is that it should refer, if I can put it that way, I think if it's going to be interpreted in accordance with the context, it should refer to, I guess, an intent to stir up extreme hatred and contempt for another person. Those sorts of things is what really it should cover.
And that would be similar to the sort of feeling about the New South Wales Anti-Discrimination Act,
exactly.
Although it doesn't use that word vilify, but yes, it uses the words incite serious hatred against or words like that.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Well, that's going to be unclear then. So merely, the question is expressing a view about, in particular, the religious position on homosexuality. Many people will say that that is inciting hatred. They'll say that it's homophobic. In some cases, it is motivated by homophobia, I suppose. But is that vilification under this law?
Well, unfortunately, it's unclear. But my view is that it ought not to be. I think that it's clearly possible for a person to express the view that Christians and most other major religions of the world have held for the last couple of thousand years, that homosexual behaviour is not in accordance with God's plan for humanity, I think that expressing a view of that sort should not be regarded as vilification, because that view presents the view from within that religious framework of what the teaching is of the text. It itself doesn't directly express hatred against another person. Mm. Indeed, as you would know from the Christian context, homosexual behaviour is regularly listed amongst a number of other pieces of behaviour that are also regarded as inconsistent with God's purposes for humanity, including envy, jealousy, greed, idolatry, in some cases disrespect to one's parents. So these things are all seen as what the Bible calls sins and acts of rebellion against God. Homosexuality is one of them, but it's not singled out as the most serious or the most terrible.
And it would also be true to say, and probably fair to make the point here, that if any person, Christian or otherwise, was expressing hatred of another person because of their sexual orientation, that also would be quite contrary to the teachings of Jesus.
It certainly would. It certainly would. Jesus offers the view that all people are valuable. The New Testament and the rest of the Bible teaches that people are made in God's image and loved by God, and they have the offer of a relationship with God. And so expressing hatred or contempt for people is contrary to the Christian worldview, and you would hope that nobody would do that.
Our guest on Open House is Professor Neil Foster. He's an associate professor at University of Newcastle and writes a really helpful blog called Law and Religion. Law and Religion Australia is the name of your blog, and it really is very helpful.
Thank you.
You could say then, if vilification is therefore something that no one wants to do, and if then isn't it a good thing to have a law against vilification? And indeed, it protects Christians. Religion is specifically named as something about which you can't vilify people.
Well, one might think so, but unfortunately, the difficulty in this area is the chilling effect that's created by words that do have an uncertain, fuzzy edge to them. So it's pretty clear if you have a law that prohibits hitting someone in the head, that whether you've hit them in the head or not. But here, this question of vilification, because of the things we've discussed, is a little bit uncertain. And so I think Christians ought to still be able to, and if they want to engage in discussion on this, engage in respectful discussion and present their views and also the view of their religious framework. But unfortunately, using this term may cause some people to be worried that they will slip over into what someone might regard as vilification.
So you're saying it'll stifle free speech potentially?
It can chill, it can restrict people's ability to speak, and I think that that's one of the problems with these areas. Problems that I've seen in the past in religious vilification laws generally, where they have sometimes created a real uncertainty. And it's not so much that you may end up being fined in court, although that might happen, but it's the fear that's sometimes generated by that, and no one wants to go through that process, of course.
Now, a few weeks back on the program, we were chatting with the Shadow Attorney General, Mark Dreyfus, and he said that the fear that someone could misuse a law like a vilification provision is no reason not to have one. But the case in point, I think, really instructive case, is what happened with Archbishop Porteous in Tasmania.
Mm.
So he puts out a marriage pamphlet. It's about the Catholic teaching on marriage. It goes to Catholic families and Catholic schools. He's taken to the Anti-Discrimination Tribunal by a member of the Greens Party who only withdraws the action because they have to fight an election. So it's never really been settled. Mm. We don't know how the tribunal might have responded on it, although they did find that there was a prima facie case, which astounded me. But I put that to Mark Dreyfus, and he said, well, look, the potential misuse of a law is no reason not to have a law. But you tend to be saying something a little bit different from that, that it might stifle reasonable free speech.
Well, it's all very well to talk about the potential misuse of law in general, but in particular, when you look at a law that's directed to speech and a law that has these as a fuzzy edges, that's a real problem. I should hasten to add, and I'm sure you're aware of this, that the Tasmanian legislation that was used in relation to Archbishop Porteous sets a much, much lower bar than this current legislation does. The Tasmanian legislation, the Anti-Discrimination Act 1998, Section 17, prohibits causing offence to someone on the basis of their sexual orientation. Now that is, most commentators around Australia, and indeed I think I'm right to say that I even saw David Marr say this the other night on TV, think that that's an inappropriately low bar to set to restrict people's freedom of speech. And so there's a good chance that if that case had been fought through to further venues such as the Supreme Court or the High Court, it would have been, the legislation might have been struck down. I think, so that's an extreme example, but the fact is that yes, it does illustrate the fact that where there's uncertainty, even if legislation can be commenced, if it's allowed to continue on, it can impose serious burdens. And in fact, I think in that Tasmanian case, if my recollection is correct, not only did the Anti-Discrimination Tribunal require Archbishop Porteous to respond, but I seem to recall that documents were sent to other Roman Catholic bishops around Australia saying that they were possibly guilty of breaching the Tasmanian law as well. So
that's right.
It was a foolish piece of litigation in my view, but it illustrates the fact that, yes, there can be dangers in these sort of things. So, I mean, saving virtues, as it were, or if you like, things that save this being such quite bad legislation in the current context, is that it's very much limited in time. It will stop, according to the current law as it stands, on the 15th of November or before then, if the statistician gets enough responses to announce a result before then. The other thing is that actions against under Section 15 have to require the prior approval of the Attorney General.
Yeah, so there are some nice balances, and it's not probably the case that people ought not be at all alarmed about this, and it may well be a protection. There is a very chilling example that's playing out through social media at the moment of an activist or writer, commentator, someone active within the LGBTI community, who essentially seems to have, and let's hope it's for satirical purposes, but even so it's pretty horrible, been party to a suggestion that what would amount on most days to a serious sexual assault ought to occur to politicians who are advocating a no case. Now, I don't want to go into it because it's pretty choice material, but would that be vilification?
Well, I'm familiar with that case, and look, it's dreadful behaviour. The actual statement was made before September the 14th, which when this legislation commenced, so perhaps the actual statement itself would not be caught. It did seem, yes, on the face of it, to threaten harm in this sort of way. Interestingly, there is a defence under Section 15 if there's a communication of matter for genuine satirical purposes.
Yeah.
And so one could argue that this was clearly satire, and I suppose that's correct. But it's the sort of behaviour that certainly one would have thought doesn't endear thoughtful persons to the sort of argument that's being put forward by that commentator.
And just briefly, while we're on the subject of the reasonable defences, I noticed that religious teaching is not one of those defences.
Yes, I think this is a serious flaw with this legislation. Other legislation, such as the New South Wales Anti-Discrimination Act, where it refers to inciting hatred against someone, etc., on the grounds of sexual orientation, for abundant caution, makes it clear that it's a defence if your comment was made in the course of a genuine, for genuine religious purposes, which would include...
For example, preaching.
Preaching in church, presenting some of the passages from the Bible that some people may find upsetting. This legislation doesn't, and it's a serious gap in my view. It covers satirical, academic or artistic purposes. So perhaps purposes like my that I can enjoy as a person who's an academic, or if I was an artist or a satirist. But it's very strange to me that they've chosen not to include one of the contexts in which one might think that this perhaps would come up, which is, yes, religious purposes, presenting of the views of a religious group. So it's unusual that that decision has been made, I think.
Well, Professor Foster, at the end of the day, what does this attempt at providing balanced and reasonable debate with protections, what does this attempt tell us about a situation that we might be faced with in the event that the marriage laws are changed? Can we draw any conclusions?
Well, it's always hard to look into the future. The fact is, though, that where marriage laws have been changed around the world, it has become a situation where there's a great deal of challenge to those who hold to the views in support of traditional marriage, heterosexual marriage, which has been supported by Christianity and other religions for many years. There have been challenges to those positions. There have been claims that groups who hold these views ought not to be able to receive funding under charitable status. There have been challenges to Christian educational institutions that they should no longer be able to teach these views. There's been a series of challenges following the changes of the law in this area, and so I think those challenges to religious freedom are a serious reason for people to think very, very carefully about supporting this change to the law of marriage.
Well, leave it there for now, but your analysis is absolutely helpful, and if people want to look up your own blog on this, again, it's lawandreligionaustralia.blog. Nice and easy to remember. Professor Neil Foster, thank you for joining us on Open House.
Thank you, Stephen.
Discover more Open House podcasts at openhousecommunity.com.au.